This is Max Q, the podcast by Peabody's Launchpad office dedicated to demystifying what life is like after graduation. Every episode, we sit down with a recent Peabody alum to get their take on what life is like for working artists in today's world. Multifaceted careers, time management, finances, finding balance between your life and your work. We explore that and more on the Max Q podcast.
Hi everyone, I'm Christina Mancior. Today's interview is with French guitarist and composer Julien Sueyrab, who graduated from Peabody in 2017. Currently based in Washington, D.C., Julien performs classical music as well as pop songs in local communities while teaching at his private studio and the International School of Music. Hello, Julien. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Christina. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to talk to you and talk to all of you guys.
Thank you. Yeah, we're really excited to have you and hear about your experience. So to get started, can you tell us a little bit about what your life looks like right now?
Well, for those of you who don't know me, I'm a guitarist. And now I live in Washington, D.C. Actually, I'm married. I live in D.C. I teach, now I teach remotely, but I used to teach in Bethesda for the International School of Music. I still teach for them, but it's just all from home now. Most of the students are online, and I also play concerts in the area, mostly Northern Virginia, D.C. and Maryland, Baltimore, Annapolis, that kind of stuff. I play a lot of retirement homes still, and just taking it day by day with the pandemic. We don't know where things are going, but I've been into making a video as well to reach out to audience. So that's pretty much it.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds like you're keeping pretty busy.
Yeah, still busy. I'm also working on writing a book. I'm writing like a composition book for classical guitar.
Oh, very cool. Composers. What is your book about?
Well, it was composers who they don't know about the guitar. And like if you open up like the instrumentation books, orchestration book, like the Adler, there's almost nothing about the guitar. So I thought, hey, I'm sure some people would be interested in knowing like actually how to write for the guitar.
Yeah, definitely. That's great.
So that's my long-term project I'm working on. I started January 2019. So I'm a year and a half in. It's slow, but I'm learning a lot as I'm actually writing the book.
So tell me more about that process. How did you decide to get started? And it's a big project. So how are you managing that in terms of time and goals timing, things like that?
So I met a guitarist through GroupMuse. GroupMuse is like a house concert kind of thing. It's a network of musicians and it connects people for concert. Anyway, I met a guitarist who was actually teaching at George Washington University. He actually teaches how to publish books. He is not a professional musician, but he's into a publication. And he said, well, the trick to making a book is actually to write a little bit every day, because otherwise you're never going to finish the book. So I try to do like an hour every day. Usually it's after lunch. That would be my book writing time if I was not doing the podcast right now. That's okay. But the trick is to really go to do it a little bit every day. And keep doing that. I started with the master plan, like everything I want to talk about, and try to put titles first, and then fill in the blanks. And then as I'm filling the blank, more ideas come. But I had like, oh yeah, I'm going to talk about harmonics. So I have a chapter about harmonics. Oh, I'm going to talk about, you know, percussions on the guitar. So I have percussions on the guitar. And then as it goes, it just grows. But it's nice to start with the table of content first and then just fill up the blank basically.
Yeah. So kind of setting up an outline for yourself and then just making sure you're allotting time for that in your schedule.
Yeah, exactly. You have to put it in your schedule. It's like practicing basically. If you don't put practicing in your schedule, yeah. Or answering emails, it's just tricky. Just like be motivated to just go answer email or, or do stuff like that. So yeah, definitely.
So, I'd love to learn more about these two things that you've mentioned, both teaching and freelance gigging, and how you kind of got started with those things. So Maybe do you want to start with one of them and we can dig into that a little bit?
So teaching, I've always taught here and there, people that I knew, people like a little private students. So I was always trying to work on building, you know, a private studio. When I was at Peabody, I actually did my master's in guitar and pedagogy. So with Laura Parker, she was an amazing teacher and I learned a lot from her. We did some like mock interviews and also getting some video as I was teaching other students. And she would give really, really good feedback. And that was really helpful. And I felt when I saw that the International School of Music was hiring, I just immediately applied because I was waiting for this kind of opportunity. And then I knew what to do. I had my portfolio. I had all my questions, all the questions they asked me. Laura Parker, she already knew the question ahead of time. So I already knew what to, I already had prepared all the questions basically. I'm still working on building my private studio. So I also teach at home. I have private students. For that, I rebuilt my whole website, the whole section about teaching. And I think the most important thing for me about my private studio was just to be available on Google. So, and it's really not hard to do. You just tell them your business and you're open. You go to Google My Business. They'll send you a little card just to verify that you actually live at that address or that the business is at that address. And you'll just put the code in there. And here you go. When a lot of my students, they just look at guitar teacher near me. And they're all from my neighborhood. Just like, well, yeah, you're like 10-minute walk from where I live. So I'm just going to, you know, come here. I mean, now most of the lessons are online, but I still have a couple of students. They want to come here.
So you're talking about Google Maps.
Yeah, Google Maps.
Having a little pinpoint on Google Maps and then people can see where you are.
Exactly. That's linked to my website. And then you can also write reviews and students often just like to write reviews and stuff. So
yeah, and that's great for then advertising in the future too.
Well, definitely. Yeah, I put some of the quotes on my website and it's just saying I'm open, I'm here and you can find me.
Yeah.
It's not going to be 100% of my income. So it's just like teaching at the international school is not 100%. None of those things would be 100% of my income. So if I was just focusing on one, it would be really hard, I think, to make it 100%. But all those things together, it's actually pretty well. It's doing pretty well.
So you mentioned that you felt really prepared for the interview at international school.
Definitely.
What were some of the things that you had thought about that helped you feel prepared for that interview?
So I think the most important question they ask is how you deal like with a student who doesn't practice. How do you deal with students that are always late or missing a lot of lessons? How do you motivate a student to learn? How do you build like a specific learning plan for each student, because each student's a little different. So how do you teach an adult versus a 5-year-old? How do you teach a 13-year-old versus an 8-year-old? And for the guitar, there's also like, oh, what if someone wants to learn the electric guitar? Can you teach the electric guitar and what repertoire? So I had to also, I looked also into like method book for electric guitar, steel string guitar, as well as classical guitar. I had to broaden it up a little bit because I think right now maybe half of my students are not doing classical, but they're doing more pop or electric guitar.
Yeah, because not everybody is going to be majoring in classical guitar and they might just want to be playing for different capacities.
Well, I feel like most of my students, they just play for fun.
Mm-hmm.
That I don't think any of them has the will and want to be a professional musician, which is fine, which is fine by me. So I'm not too hard on them. I try to make sure they practice. But they're just so fun to watch grow and it's just taking interest in the instrument. That's why I love teaching.
Yeah, it's inspiring to see people who love music and they do that in their downtime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Just as impressive as those who study music all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What about freelancing? Can we talk more about how you have gotten involved with that? Because I know you, in school, you started this program with the retirement communities. Mm-hmm. And then I know you also are really active as gigging at background music and other types of concerts around Baltimore and DC?
Well, when I graduated, I knew that if I were to make money gigging, I would start with retirement homes, because that's where I was living, literally living in a retirement home for 2 years. And I had a lot of content. Well, there was several media outlets. They came and they made some documentaries about me playing guitar. There was also one with Peggy, who is a harpist we were working with at the time, and Sarah, who is a flute player. And I thought, well, that's a good looking documentary there. And I'm sure I can get some gigs just playing at a retirement home like this. So once again, I used Google. I went to Google and I looked at all the retirement homes in the area, all of them. And I called them all. And I made a numbers or like Excel spreadsheet where I would put the name. What's really important to me was to get the name of the activity director and their number. If I could get their direct line, that's even better. Most of the time, those people never answer the phone because they're never in their office, because they're always busy doing activities. And I know that because I was living at a retirement home. And if they don't pick up the phone, that's mostly like 99% of the time because they're not in the office. They're just busy organizing activity for the residents.
So I would just keep calling. They're not ignoring you on purpose.
Yeah, no, they're not ignoring you on purpose. I would just keep calling. At some point, I think I was making 50 phone calls. Like after I graduated, I was like 50 phone calls a day. And then leave messages. And then sometimes I would just talk to the person at the front desk and just try to get to know them, try to get to know their name. And it's like, oh, yeah, Julianne, remember you called yesterday? Yeah, yeah. She's not here today. But maybe if you call between 9 and 10 tomorrow, she'll be in her office. So it's a slow process. And I mean, I remember when I was doing the business of music class at Peabody, the teacher was saying, well, you're probably going to have like out of 100 phone calls, you're going to have 5 people will answer the phone and maybe you'll book 1 or 2 gigs. And that was pretty accurate, actually.
Yeah.
And right now, I played at a lot of different retirement homes. Some of them didn't want to pay me. And at first, I just did it once or twice and then I didn't do it again. But I ended up trying to bring them to another level instead of playing to more retirement homes. And so I say, oh, would you like to book me on a regular basis? So now I'm playing monthly at 2 retirement homes. We've also done some online concert, but now it's back in person. But I thought, well, with all the email and no phone calls, I think it's better if I try to find clients that just want me back. And so I would save time. I would save time on just, and it's also frustrating. Looking for gigs is super frustrating. And so I was like, I would save time on my computer if I just find clients who would want to hire me on a monthly basis.
Yeah. So it's like maximizing the relationships you have.
Exactly.
And then saying, okay, this is working. Let's do more of it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when I'm playing, I'm always trying to take, even if I don't know the song, but I say, can you make some requests of songs that you want me to do? And people would ask me to play some specific pieces and I would just make a note. And then the next time I would go, I would actually know the piece and say, oh, you requested that piece last time. So here's the piece for you that I've learned this time. And this also really, really brings in the relationship with an audience and then the activity director is like, oh, yeah, the resident really liked what you did today. Would you want to come back another time?
And I'm sure that's great for the residents, too, because mm-hmm. I'm sure they really appreciate that you give that kind of personalized attention.
They get to
attention.
Know me. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, after I was with retirement home, there's a limit on how many retirement home gigs you can do. And I try to diversify into more like corporate events, weddings, birthday parties, all kind of different festivals and stuff like that.
How do those differ from booking retirement homes?
Well, because I'm not the one looking for them. They're the one looking for me.
That helps,
so
yeah.
I use the Bash, who used to be Gig Masters. There's also a Gig Salad. It's a great tool to get gigs. You get listed in there. And then we have to pay like a fee every year, but it's worth it. I was on the not also for weddings for a while. That was not as much worth it as the other two. I think the not and the bash are the same owners. But being on those platforms, if you're successful and you got good reviews, then for example, if you're typing classical guitarist Washington DC, well, you won't find me right away. But if you type on the bash, I'm probably in the top 10. So people get to see who I am and what I do. So it's pretty helpful. I got to book several gigs through those platforms. That was really helpful.
What about negotiating your rates? How do you decide your rates and how do you get people to pay the rates that you want?
Finding the right rate is probably the hardest thing to do. It evolves. If you start too low, then you're not motivated to go work. If you have a night check at the end of the day, it's like, oh yes, I'm gonna, you know, it motivates you, of course, to be paid more or what you deserve. Well, it's a lot of trial and errors. You wanna see what people budget is. I think now a lot of time when their budget is too low, I just rather not book the gig, because I know I'm going to be able to book a gig at the rate that I want. So I think you want to start with a budget. And for guitarists, it's probably very different than like a concert pianist or someone doing like a concerto or, you know, you want to set your minimum rate and you start with that to say, oh, I would do like $250 for an hour. Like that's going to be including like transportation, amplification, stuff like that. And then once you overbooked and you can't take any more gigs, then you bring that up. So, I mean, there's a few gigs you're going to lose, but then all the other gigs you're going to make more money. So you can, for me, it was like, I could only bring my rate up when I was booked. 2019, I think I played 130 live performances. And then I thought 2020, oh, I'm just going to raise my rate. So I lost a few gigs, but the one that I kept, I would make more money. So overall, I would make the same amount of money, but play a little less and not be like overwhelmed. I was sometimes you get overbooked. If your rate is too low, you just get overbooked. I played 3 gigs in one day.
Oh my gosh. That's a lot.
It was just insane. Yeah.
How do you keep all the repertoire straight?
two hospitals and well, yeah, it was just yeah. It was just a lot.
Yeah, but that makes a lot of sense. So as you get more and more gigs at the rate that you're happy with, then you can start to say, okay, my time is now worth more and mm-hmm. I'm going to raise my rate, play less gigs, but make the same amount of money. And then it continues to go upwards like that.
Exactly. I mean, someone says, oh, well, you know, it's not our budget. You say, well, unless it's like for the next day, you can negotiate. But if it's like a few weeks or a few months from now, you say, well, someone's going to book me on that day anyway. So I'm probably going to get another gig at the rate that I want. So I'd rather, you know, there's other guitarists out there. And, but I think there's also something weird. Like if you give an insane price, let's just say $1,500, $2,000 or something like that, some people think, oh, this guy must be really good. So sometimes some people, they'll think, oh, I'm going to pay a little more because since I pay more, it's probably higher quality, which is not always true. But that's something that's a little strange about the business, about that. And people don't often realize it's hard to tell what the real value of a performance is. Like, it's art. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I mean, and your preparation time goes back years. It's not just the practicing you do for that event. You're also have to value all of that previous time you spent learning how to play the guitar in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And it probably helps to start with rates that you are okay with in the first place. Because if you're not sacrificing your rates, then you're probably less likely to end up in a situation like that where you're being offered way more money.
Yeah, exactly. Else. It's possible. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When that happened, it's your fault. You should stick to the original plan.
Yeah.
I don't think you should cancel on people. I think it's just disrespectful.
And it sounds like you have a contract, which also, how does that help you to, how does that, and so it's obviously safety for the people booking you, but is it also safety for you?
Well, yeah. Well, I was actually thinking of putting like a penalty to myself in the contract in case I cancel or something, just to people realize that I'm actually serious. For me, the security is I always ask for 50% deposit at the time of booking. And if they cancel within 30 days of the event, then the full amount is due. And most of the time, I mean, most of the events don't get canceled. Or if it does, if it's more than 30 days, then I have my deposit. If it's less than 30 days, they understand that, well, I booked the date and other people call me for that day and I say, I'm already booked. So I can refer you to someone else, but I can't take the gig. So if they cancel me and I make zero money on that day, that's a big loss for me. So that's why I always require a 50% deposit. And that's why it's payment in full if it's canceled within 30 days, because sometimes you don't necessarily always get like last minute gigs or stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like a great practice and definitely something that we recommend as well, making sure that you have your bases covered.
Well, having a contract also shows that you're serious. It's like a structure. It's like, oh yeah, sure, I'll be there. You don't need to pay me for now. It's like they have no guarantee that you're actually going to show up. A contract and a deposit is a good guarantee that I'm going to be there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you graduated how many years ago now? Is it
2017.
So, okay. And what has surprised you most about life after graduation? So going from school to being out in the real world, so to speak.
Well, what was difficult at first is getting to practice, getting motivated to practice, especially at the beginning when you don't have any gigs, you don't have a recital coming up, you don't have your teacher. I thought actually of like carving like a cardboard version of Julian Gray, like one-on-one, you know, putting the side of my room and just like, you know, with a bubble that say practice. just like if every time I walk in there, it was like, oh my, no, I gotta go practice. But I think getting the motivation at first, I think, was the hardest part. And like, you don't have like setting yourself your own goals. I think I was doing that a little bit at Peabody, especially with retirement home. I was already working on a website, but out in the real world is adapting to what people want. It's not like, oh, I'm going to make like a nice program. It's like, oh, how am I going to reach out to people? How am I going to make people interested in what I do? More than anything else. Yeah. Once you get started and when you get gigs and then you have a gig coming up, I got to practice. And you think about it, you want to do well, you want to play well, so then that's the motivation to practice. But like the few months after graduation, maybe the first summer, it's really easy to just relax, especially how intense mm-hmm. Peabody is and the amount of work that we have to do. It's okay to relax a little bit. But you don't want to relax for too long.
Right. You don't want to lose your momentum.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you describe your experience creating the program with the retirement home while you were in school and how that impacted your journey through school?
The way it happened, and it mostly happened by chance, like a lot of things in life, is that I was motivated to play more in front of an audience. I think that was my number one motivation, is that I was really nervous on stage, and I knew that if I just play, not just in my practice room, but play in front of people, not just in rep class once a week or once a month, but every day or like five times a week. I had the idea that by doing this, I would be able to practice my rep on stage and be able to be more comfortable being on stage, being able to talk about the music more comfortably. So I don't know if it still exists, but I went to Creative Access at Peabody, which
it does still exist.
It does still exist. Okay, yeah. Good. Because that's what really got me started was through Creative Access, because Creative Access is like, oh, we're doing outreach. You're just going to play at hospitals, children with cancers, retirement home, the VA center. a lot of different places. We'll drive you. You just bring your guitar and play, and you can do as many as you want of these. You just have to sign up. I was like, okay, let me look at my schedule. I started doing a lot of these, and that really helped me getting comfortable on stage. Then from there, they offered me a position. They say, well, since you're so much involved, why don't you work for us? And then just become a site coordinator. Became a site coordinator the same year that Springwell, the retirement home in which I live in, started the program to be part of Creative Access. So I was the first point of contact of Springwell, and I would bring student there, but sometimes people would not be able to play a full hour, so I would play the remaining half an hour. And then they asked me, you know, with the head of the director of the retirement home, say, you know, Julian, we're actually looking for someone to live with the residents as an artist in residence program. Would you be interested? And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll do it. That sounds like a great plan, because it was in the continuation of what I was already doing, but just one level up. It's like, oh, living with them means I'm going to be playing. You're going to be playing for them every day. I'm like, no problem. And the practice, it's weird, because at that point when I was living at Springwell, I was a better performer. I was better performing than I was practicing. Like, practicing was, I'd become like my weak spot. I was bad at practicing because all I did was performing.
Wow.
So I became bad at just like focusing on one thing and just repeated it. I would always have people come by, so I would have to play and perform. And it's not a bad problem to have. It was,
definitely not.
It's the opposite when, oh, you're really good in your room, and then you feel like you're at 10% when you perform, and then you perform more and you feel 20%, and then you perform more and you feel better on stage. But in my case, I felt more comfortable on stage than just practicing on my own, because the focus, because you're like, oh, your mind is in the mindset of performing. So it just works differently. The brain just works differently. And I'm way more focused when I'm on stage than when I'm just practicing in my room. And he ended up being way more positive.
What's great is that this program still exists at Peabody now. And
I'm glad. Yeah. I'm
other very happy students about that. Are still following in your footsteps and hopefully having these similar experiences to grow and perform. So while you were at Peabody, did you come in with very established goals and priorities? And if so, did they change through your time in school?
Well, I wanted to be the best guitar in the world. That obviously didn't happen. It's interesting. When I arrived at Peabody, I knew I wanted to just... My number one goal was to improve myself, not necessarily be better than others. I've never participated in a competition, which is strange for a classical musician, because everybody else that I know, they go to competition, they go and they perform. I've always found that stressful, or I don't know. It was never I would never want to compare myself to others in a way. I would just say, oh, we're different. We have different artistry. Who is better? Am I better than you? Are you, especially at Peabody everybody's pretty good. I've never done a single competition, and I just wanted to share music. I just wanted to become the best guitarist that I could. And I think that goal is still there with me today. Peabody really helped me refine my goal with, I also write music. And I was really lucky that Julian Gray actually embraced that and listened to my composition, giving me some advice on several of my composition. He was, when I recorded my first album, he was encouraging me. It was that's not the kind of experience I had in France, when my teacher didn't really care about my competition. About my compositions. I just had to learn the repertoire he wanted me to learn. With Julian, it was more like, oh, well, and I see that not just with me, but with other musicians. Guitarists would be, oh, I like really contemporary guitar, like newer stuff, I like to get new guitar wrote for new work for classical guitar. And he would just encourage that aspect of them. And I think that really helped me define who I was. I already kind of knew it was kind of within me, but I think going to Peabody really refined that and really make it come out even more, which I really liked.
Have you faced any significant setbacks through your time in school and afterwards that you feel have altered the trajectory of what you were working on in your artistic work?
So I think it was in my last year at Peabody, I started feeling like weird sensation in my right hand. And I later got a diagnosis with dystonia, which is like a neurological disease that basically sends the wrong information to your hand. It tells my finger to contract and expand at the same time. So it's not always great when you try to play guitar. So I had to work around it, finding new ways of practicing. I've seen many doctors, but I haven't really found a treatment that works for this. I readapted my repertoire. Maybe I was not trying to go to the hardest, fastest piece, but maybe something a little more accessible that would be a little better for my hand. Try to always put that my health as a priority first, because in the long run, if you can't play, then it doesn't really matter how many years you've been studying music if you can't show up and play. So I also try to develop my voice and adding more and more singing into my repertoire, because it's still an interesting trajectory to take. I felt like in classical guitar I was kind of stuck practicing because I couldn't get any better, especially with dystonia. And I feel like singing, I could improve every day. I could feel myself improving, which I really enjoy. And then it's not as demanding for the right hand. The left hand is still can be pretty tricky. The right hand strumming, it's a different technique that I think more a little more adapt to my conditions. But hopefully, I mean, I still teach. There's no problem. I can still play duets with my students. There's no problem. I would not see myself like play a concerto or doing
that's
something.
That's gonna be a challenge to work with. And yeah. I hope that you are able to find some like improvements to the condition as time goes on too. Do you have any advice for current students at Peabody?
Current student at Peabody, in the pandemic time, it might be hard for me to give really good insight, but in normal time, I would say just play. And play by the sense, not perform or not practice. You know, play and enjoy playing. It's easy when you go into the practice room. There's not always windows. You're just you and the music. It's easy to get lost into why you're actually playing music. Or are you still even playing music? I think you're your own audience. You're the first audience because you hear the music you play all the time. Like never play a piece of music you don't like. There's a million pieces of music out there to learn. There's like, and if you don't like anything, just write your own music. But I feel like, yeah, never play a piece of music you don't like. It's like, oh, I don't have a good feeling about that piece, but my teacher really wants me to play it. I've heard that so many times. I don't know. Sometimes that happened to me, and it took me maybe 5 years to actually like the piece by listening to it. And then eventually it's like, oh, maybe I could see myself learning that now, 5 years down the road, but maybe 5 years earlier, not necessarily. So yeah, play music and play what you like, first of all.
Well, thank you so much, Julian. It's been
of course
a pleasure to have you here today.
Yes, well, thank you so much for having me.
You can learn more about Julian at his website, julianguitar.com. That's JULIENguitar.com. Thanks for listening. Julian for allowing us to share an excerpt of his composition Through the Telescope to close out our episode. 2021 theme music for the Max Q podcast, created by Dimitro Nebish.